Monday, March 28, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The year was 1984, and in that year, at the Democratic National Convention, the presidential nominee, Senator Walter Mondale, asked Geraldine Ferraro, a New York congresswoman, to be his running mate. She became the first woman to be one of the two at the top of a national party ticket, and of course the first woman to run for the office of Vice President of the United States. In so doing, Geraldine Ferraro made history. She died this past Saturday at age 75 after being treated for blood cancer. Now, looking back at the 1984 presidential campaign, we can find a couple of very instructive lessons for our current day. In the first place, we are reminded of the fact that no woman had indeed been a part of a national ticket until 1984. And in this case, the particular woman chosen, Geraldine Ferraro, was a very well-known, very outspoken, very liberal feminist. You have to fast forward to the year 2008 when Senator John McCain, atop the Republican ticket for that year, chose Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Now, Sarah Palin became only the second woman to be one of the two nominees at the top of a party ticket. Sarah Palin, of course, is a political conservative. One of the lessons to be drawn from this is that at least at this point, having a woman on the ticket has not been a game changer in order to bring about a win. After all, looking back at 1984, Ronald Reagan, then the incumbent president of the United States, running along with Vice President George H.W. Bush, carried 49 of 50 states, a landslide by any estimation. And in the year 2008, the ticket that included Sarah Palin as the vice presidential nominee lost to President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. The second lesson to be drawn from all of this is that political polarization is nothing new. One of the frustrations of our current day is that the mass media, the intellectual elites, and any number of common citizens think that the current season in American life is unusually partisan. That is actually not the case. Though serious issues ranging from social and moral questions to issues of foreign policy and economics do divide the American electorate, the reality is that today's partisan divides are no more acrimonious and certainly no deeper in terms of cultural cleavage than what was true way back in 1984. Now, of course, even in 1984, it was hardly new. There was once a day when on the floor of the House of Representatives or the Senate, there were not only strong words, but sometimes even physical actions that were taken. We're not in that level of political acrimony, but there is a very deep values and political divide that continues to separate the two different wings of the American electorate. One, of course, more closely identified with what are called progressivist or liberal causes, and on the other side, those who are very concerned to contend for conservative convictions. The divide between the red states and the blue states is real, even though in most elections, the swing middle actually makes the decisive difference. But looking back also at 1984, it's interesting that so many of the same issues are currently matters of deep division and very live debate. Geraldine Ferraro was an advocate of abortion rights. And when you look at the other parts of the feminist agenda, and you look at the issues of debate between, for instance, the Republican and Democratic platforms of the year 1984, you'll see that things change and things do not. This much is clear. A lively democracy requires a lively exchange of ideas. In our political system, it is the presidential campaigns every 4 years that bring these issues most close to the surface and most active in terms of debate. That is true in the year 2011 as we look to the year 2012 and yet another presidential campaign. It was true back in 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro made history running as the first woman to be nominated for the office of Vice President of the United States. Once again, we are reminded that life is but a vapor. Even the most significant and controversial of lives soon pass into the history books. The situation in Libya continues to unfold, and in recent days, several changes have taken place. First of all, the leadership of the effort that is now joined by America and several allies is under the control of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This was, as promised by President Obama, a shift from American leadership, But even as NATO is now supposedly in control, no one seems to know exactly how this effort is being directed, nor where it is expected to go. Now, a fascinating exchange on the issue of Libya has laid bare a more basic difference in American opinion, both at the elite and policy levels and at the common level, about how American military force should be used. Senator John Kerry, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, writes in a very effusive opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend that, and I quote, "What is happening in the Middle East could be the most important geostrategic shift since the fall of the Berlin Wall," end quote. Senator Kerry said, quote, "Everything I believe about the proper use of American force and the ability of the community of nations to speak with one voice was reaffirmed when the world refused to stand by and accept a bloody final chapter of the uprisings sweeping across North America and the Middle East. With a mandate from the Arab League and the Gulf states, the United Nations Security Council approved a limited military intervention to avoid a massacre. Multilateralism may be messy, but it's powerful when diplomacy pays off," end quote. Now, what makes this piece particularly interesting is that Senator Kerry points to the fact that this was a humanitarian effort. There is no more quintessential statement of the kind of liberal interventionism than what Senator Kerry provides in this article. He is absolutely enthusiastic about the use of American military force in this case, and pointing to the effort in Libya, he says that everything he believes about the proper use of American force comes into view in this particular project. Now, the big question to be asked, of course, is exactly what we are trying to do and how we will know if it is successful. President Obama finally spoke to members of Congress about this, meeting on Friday with 21 legislators of bipartisan character from both the House and the Senate as well, as he tried to explain U.S. aims. According to Laura Meckler and Carol Lee of the Wall Street Journal, the president said that U.S. involvement would fall as other nations step up and that allowing a humanitarian crisis to unfold would go, quote, "against everything we stand for," end quote. Now, one of the interesting questions to ask about that is how this particular threat to civilian life in Libya all of a sudden became a humanitarian crisis that we could not stand by and allow to happen, whereas very similar things are happening elsewhere. For instance, right now in Yemen, where the president of Yemen has also been firing on his own citizens, but there is absolutely no talk about American involvement in that case. Somehow, we have to believe that public opinion is driving at least part of this. But public opinion is also greatly divided. A Gallup poll that was released last week said that a plurality of Americans approve of military action, but that plurality is not a majority. It's only 47%. As many have noted, that is the lowest in 40 years of Gallup, as Gallup has done research on public opinion at the onset of a military conflict. Now, this has left President Obama in a rather vulnerable situation. One of the questions we should ask about the situation is what it reveals about the challenge of leadership, and in particular, presidential leadership. One of the most interesting aspects or considerations of all of this is offered by Peggy Noonan, well known as a speechwriter for President Reagan and later for President H.W. Bush. In an article entitled "The Speech Obama Hasn't Given," also published as an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Peggy Noonan discusses the fact that President Obama has not yet spoken to the American people about his aims and purposes in this military effort. Now, as a footnote, the White House has announced that the president will speak to the nation tonight. But writing over the weekend, Peggy Noonan suggested, in an article entitled "The Speech Obama Hasn't Given," that it is almost unprecedented in American history, especially in the age of the media, that a president of the United States would launch a military effort such as this without speaking virtually immediately to the American people. As she talks about the speech that the president has not given, she says this. Now, as she speaks about this, she says, "I cannot for the life of me see how an American president can launch a serious military action without a full and formal national address in which he explains to the American people why he is doing what he is doing, why it is right, and why it is very much in the national interest." Now, she also says, "Without a formal and extended statement, the air of weirdness, uncertainty, and confusion that surrounds this endeavor will only deepen." Now, Ms. Noonan is a conservative, And she's writing, of course, assuming that there will be other conservatives who will have trouble with this liberal interventionism. But even as she writes, she knows that the Republican Party is deeply divided over this issue. Clarity can only be brought when action is explained in terms of ideas. At the end of her article, she says that the president needs to sit down and tell the American people how this thing can possibly turn out well. He needs to tell them why it isn't mad, end quote. Why would she speak so strongly? Well, a bit of evidence comes from Robert D. Kaplan, one of the major foreign policy analysts of our day, who suggests that the Middle East is going to be, as it has been for most of living memory, a cauldron of trouble for the United States. He points out that Libya is by no means the most important of the nations currently in turmoil in the Middle East, as violence and unrest has broken out in nations such as now Syria and Jordan, while countries far closer to American vital interests are now at stake. And of course, looking at Bahrain and Yemen and the Gulf states, ultimately including Saudi Arabia, what we see is a reshaping that may be to the advantage of Iran and to the disadvantage of the United States, and certainly also to the disadvantage of our friends in Israel. Now, one interesting thing that Robert Kaplan writes in this is an explanation of why the United States needs a relatively stable world. He says this: "The United States may be a democracy, but it is also a status quo power whose position in the world depends upon the world staying as it is," end quote. Well, as it is, it seems more and more clear that the world is not going to stay the way that it is. We'll all see what President Obama has to say as he does speak to the American people tonight. Finally, Sunday's edition of the New York Times had one of those articles that makes us take pause and realize we're not very good at adding up the value of things. For instance, in this case, Sam Grobart, writing in the technology column of Sunday's paper, suggests that we are now spoiled by the all-in-one gadget, or in this case, specifically, the smartphone. Americans pay relatively low rates for smartphone use, but tend to complain about the rates. Now, one of the things that Mr. Grobart does in his article is to point out that the smartphone is actually a computer with rather amazing power. He says this: "To do all the things a smartphone can do without buying one, that same consumer would need to buy the following: a cell phone," he evaluates that at $800 over 24 months, "a mobile email reader, approximately $430, or perhaps as low as $70 with some years of service, a music player, compared to a Nano, that iPod, that cost $149, a point-and-shoot camera, he throws in $200, a camcorder, another $200, a GPS unit, well, about $100, a portable DVD player, about $60, a voice recorder, $40, a watch, $30, a calculator, $10, total cost, virtually $2,000. He says this: "In a smartphone, all these devices are reduced to software. They're a tap away, and new functions or services can be downloaded in seconds. Meanwhile, by the way, a smartphone enables us to both receive and send information that can go almost instantaneously all around the globe. How much is that worth? Well, for most of us, it's worth whatever we have to pay, because the cost of not having that capacity turns out to be almost disastrous for business or for communication, or for that matter, parents even trying to keep in touch with their kids. The reality is that we're now talking about a technology that didn't exist just a few years ago, and a capacity that we now take for granted. So it turns out that human beings are probably not very good at evaluating things and putting evaluation on technology. It's also probably true that we have a very short memory of just how these revolutionary and radical new technologies have reshaped our lives such that we think of them now as normal. In the scope of human history, it's anything but." Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Today I'm speaking to you from Florida. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com, where you'll find an article that addresses a question I was asked by the New York Times: must a pastor be married? You'll find that article and many others by going to albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.